Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, the abrupt resignation of a St. George Republican representative and the allegations that he engaged a prostitute during visits to Salt Lake City. Also, a Trump administration official with ties to Utah's senators resigns after allegations of abuse by his ex-wives. Plus, a proposed tax break for a radioactive waste company, a bill to prohibit secret recordings in Utah, and more. Joining me for this conversation, Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham is here. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
Also, health, education, and environment editor Tony Semerad. Welcome and good morning.
Good morning.
News columnist Robert Gerke is in studio with us as well. Good morning, Robert.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And on the phone from Washington, we've got Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Berg. Good morning, Tommy.
Hey, good morning.
And listeners, if you would like to join this conversation with your questions or comments, you can call us. We're at 801-355-8255, or you can post your comments or questions at sltrib.com. And let's begin with news that broke this week that then kept evolving. This is St. George Republican Representative John Stannard resigned. He did so abruptly, and one reason was initially given, and then another explanation for his resignation emerged. Matt Canham, can we talk about the timeline of events here? Representative Stannard told fellow Republican lawmakers on
Tuesday
that he was stepping down.
Yes, it was very quick, and he said it was a family matter. He had some conversation with House Speaker Greg Hughes, and we're not exactly sure what happened in that because the speaker will not tell us. He said it was a private conversation. But he also said he did not know that a news story was coming out.
Speaker Hughes said that?
Speaker Hughes said that. What reporters heard from the representative is that he had a sick father that he wanted to see, and I believe in Montana. And so he had to quickly leave. His desk was cleared out very fast. Bills were transferred to other people. And reporters were then suddenly trying to figure out what could have happened. It didn't make sense that he was leaving for a sick father because there were emergency caucus meetings among lawmakers. It just didn't seem – if you had someone who had a sick relative, you offer your condolences and you tell people what happened and you move on. And that's not what happened in this case. So we tried very hard to figure it out. And then on Wednesday morning, the Daily Mail in London popped a story about – Bree Taylor, who is a call girl in the Salt Lake City area, who has text messages with, or at least purports to have text messages with the representative about at least two encounters in Salt Lake City in the summer of 2017 that coincide with legislative meetings where he would have come up from St. George and she said that he paid her $250 for each one of these one-hour sessions.
Okay. And this is during interim session meetings at the legislature, during the time frame that those would have been happening at the Capitol.
Right. And in, the Associated Press reports that taxpayers paid for those hotel rooms.
Okay.
And that the House leadership is considering asking him to reimburse them that money.
The Tribune and various other publications point out that Stannard, who is married, Mormon, and promoted family values on his website, his campaign website, that he also voted for stricter penalties for things like prostitution, pornography, and so on. Has there been a response from Representative Stannard, Matt?
Not that I have seen. His lawyer has spoke out for him, but pretty much just this is what the lawyer said. He said, given the current climate in this country with misconduct allegations and the way things are happening in the media right now, there isn't any explanation that my client could give that would overcome the shadow of these allegations. But Stannard has not responded to our request for comment.
That's not exactly a denial, though, either. I mean,
it's not at all.
Okay. What do legislative leaders say about this scandal? You said that you haven't been able to get much of a comment from Speaker Hughes, but otherwise?
They have tried to just not talk to anybody. And there was a confusion, and they briefly removed reporters from areas of the Capitol where reporters usually have free reign because they did not want to talk about this yesterday.
How did that happen? The removing reporters.
Well, what happened is the group of reporters actually caught up with House Speaker Greg Hughes, who who just said that, you know, he wanted to respect the representative's privacy. And then somehow there was some communication between the speaker, his staff, and security officers, and they removed the reporters from the chamber and the hallway. And then they later called that a misunderstanding.
You mentioned that there was a reporting this morning that Standard used a hotel stipend, a state stipend, yeah, to pay for these hotel rooms. There's this quote in the Tribune from Senate President John Valentine that I just want to throw out here. He says, quote, obviously this wasn't done here or around the Capitol. It was done in his personal life somewhere. People have their personal lives. You've got to be careful when you're a legislator, unquote. I guess that's true. This is a personal matter, consenting adults, et cetera. I guess what I'm wondering is his resignation, you know, the end of this from the states? You talked about them having to reimburse, or him having to reimburse these costs, but will he face any other kind of repercussions, Matt?
For this, I don't know. I mean, that's hard to tell. I mean, I guess if you wanted to go to an extreme, you could have law enforcement try to charge him for something like that. I don't know if that would necessarily happen.
Also, I said Senate President John Valentine. I meant Niederhauser.
Yes.
Sorry about that. Yeah.
You know, I don't think there's, you know, I think that would be unlikely at this stage, but it's totally possible. I think this is more of a public reprimand. And it's, you know, in politics in Utah, this is a hard one to get past.
Robert Gerke, Tribune news columnist, is there, you know, much to learn from honest, I don't know what to ask you here. This is kind of a new one for me. What do you make of this?
I guess what we learn is don't send text messages to call girls from your state-funded, taxpayer-funded phone. And, you know, look, we've had things like this happen in the past. It's not the first of its kind, but it's pretty explosive. And it's a guy that he was pretty ambitious. He was, you know, considering running for a leadership position in the near future, I think. And, you know, and so to have this happen, you know, and then there's the hypocrisy factor to it. The guy who's the upstanding, you know, family man, the guy who's voted to stiffen penalties for, you know, fines for prostitution, that, you know, and so it was surprising. I mean, look, when he announced his resignation, everybody was speculating, I guess, about what could have precipitated this. And, you know, that's always in the back of your mind that maybe it's a sex scandal because, you know, but you know, that's not the direction most people were going. So I think when this dropped, it was a bombshell.
What happens now to, you know, his vacant seat, for example? Does anybody have go ahead. Sorry, Gerke, Robert.
Yeah. So the Washington County Republican Party said they're going to try to have an election, a special election, gather the delegates together and pick a replacement by Monday. So they're doing this on a very rapid time frame. They want somebody in office by Wednesday because right now, you know, they're kind of in the thick of the session. And those, you know, those constituents deserve to have some representation in the body.
Okay. Well, a scandal appears to be the, you know, the end of a political career for one Utah lawmaker. I want to turn now to another Utah-connected politics story that also involves a degree of scandal. And for the details, I'll turn to Thomas Burr, Tribune Washington bureau chief. And Tommy, I'm alluding here to Rob Porter, a White House official who has also resigned. Let's start with what led to that resignation, some accusations as well.
Sure. So Rob Porter is the former chief of staff to Senator Orrin Hatch. He served as general counsel to Senator Mike Lee. He has some other Utah connections, big Utah family ties, as well as he attended a year at Brigham Young University. So he's in this job, which is pretty important. It's staff secretary at the White House. So he's pretty much in charge of all the paperwork that goes to the president's desk. So he's in the Oval Office pretty much daily. He traveled with the president. He was one of the chief authors of the State of the Union speech last week. And so, you know, he's in his lofty position. Early this week, the Daily Mail, a British tabloid, published allegations from two of his two ex-wives, saying that he physically abused them, emotionally abused them, when they were married. At one point, Colby Holderness came forward with a picture of her with a black eye that she said that he gave her when they were in Florence, Italy. So Rob Porter, initially the White House pushed back, and they were trying to say, he's an honorable man. He can stay. The Chief of Staff John Kelly apparently tried to get him to stick with it and fight the charges. Fight's probably not the right word to use right there, but, to stick around. But Porter ended up resigning his position, and it continues to learn more and more about this. We see that the two women apparently went to their Mormon bishops, for example, for help, saying that their husband was being abusive, and they say that the Mormon bishops weren't helpful. At one point, they said, you need to consider his career ambitions and how much this could hurt him.
Yeah, and the. Just to continue on that, Tommy, the Mormon Church spoke to this yesterday. A spokesman for the church said that it had the church has zero tolerance for abuse of any kind, right?
Yeah, so the church said they couldn't speak to the specifics of the situation, of what happened when the women approached their Mormon bishops, but that there should be a zero tolerance towards any type of abuse. and we hope that's the case. Let's also point out that Mormon bishops are lay leaders. They don't really get training in, marriage counseling or anything like that. So they're, maybe not equipped to deal with it. Although for the women, that was their, source of... They're one resource they could go to easily to try to get help, and they say they got none.
I want to remind listeners that you can join this conversation with your questions and comments. We're at 801-355-8255, or you can comment at sltrib.com. Tommy, okay, so the church, as an entity kind of writ large, says one thing, says, zero tolerance. But Porter's ex-wives report that their experience with their Mormon bishops, as you're saying, at the ward level was something different. And I mean, what did they say to that disconnect? Do the women address the disconnect between sort of the church overarching policy ideas and what happens at the ward level, the neighborhood level?
I try to reach out to both women. I have not spoken to them, so I'm usually quoting them from their conversations with the Daily Mail or the Intercept, an online publication.
Right.
And I should also just, from the outset, Porter denies these charges.
Right.
He says that there's a lot more to this, that they're not telling the real story. So I want to be clear there.
Sure.
But the women, pretty much say that until they went outside, like one of them went to a secular counselor, to actually, a professional counselor, and that's when she realized that, what she was in was a toxic situation she needed to get out of. So that's they're saying they pretty much went to the church for help, and were told to stick with it.
Porter, as we mentioned, has these a few Utah connections. He attended Brigham Young University for a period of time. He worked for both Senators Hatch and Lee. Tommy, Senator Hatch, from what I understand, had a couple of responses to this. First one, and then another response. Talk about that part of the story, Tommy.
Sure. So we learned a little more about that last night. Daily Beast had a story that made a little more sense of why the two different statements. Just pulling this up real fast. So the first statement from Hatch came out Tuesday night, pretty much in coordination with the White House. The White House reached out to the senator and said, will you defend your former top aide? So Hatch issues a statement. He says, it's incredibly discouraging to see such a vile attack on such a decent man. Shame on any publication that would print this, and shame on any politically motivated, morally bankrupt character assassins that would attempt to sully a good man's name. So that came out Tuesday night. Wednesday, after we see the picture of Holderness with a black eye, the senator issued a new statement saying he was heartbroken by the allegations, that Rob's always been courteous, professional, and respectful, but domestic violence in any form is abhorrent and unacceptable. So the difference between the two is seems to be the picture. When it came out with more allegations, then we see a different comment.
So from the get-go, Senator Hatch's, I don't want to say default, but what he was assuming was that this was some sort of smear campaign, coordinated attack against him. Is that that's what I'm hearing?
Yeah, pretty much. And then we don't know what they told the senator either. Maybe the senator wasn't aware of what all the allegations were.
Okay.
And maybe he just heard that some people were trying to go against him. That at one point there was The White House is pushing the storyline that Corey Lewandowski, former campaign manager to Trump, was kind of behind this effort to attack Rob Porter. So maybe that's what he knew. And when the Daily Mail story came out and The Intercept came out and we see the picture, then we see a different side.
And Senator Mike Lee, who had also employed Porter at one point, any response from him, Tommy?
He has declined comments. Got nothing from his office.
Okay.
I think if I just could jump in, one of the things that I think is really telling about this, I know Rob Porter has denied the allegations, but one of the things, the aspects of this that I think is kind of telling is that he couldn't get his FBI, his security clearance. And this is a job that deals with classified information on an hour-to-hour basis. I mean, it's a constant flow of classified information. He couldn't get his security clearance because the FBI had investigated this and said, we can't give him a top security clearance. And so I think that kind of says that maybe, at least from the FBI standpoint, there's something to these allegations.
Tommy,
can I just clarify that?
Go ahead.
Raj Shah, the principal White House deputy press secretary, said yesterday that Porter and apparently some other White House officials were actually working on a temporary security clearance so that he legally could see the classified information, but they hadn't finished their investigation. So they never technically denied Porter a security clearance, but they never gave him one either, even after more than a year of their investigation.
Just to be clear, Porter is no longer working at the White House, right? He resigned and is not involved there.
Yeah, he resigned Thursday, from what I understand. He resigned Wednesday, and yesterday he apparently came in to get some of his personal effects, but he's out.
And so I think the next question we have to ask is, who knew what and when did they know it? I mean, John Kelly has apparently knew about this for quite a while. You don't work in the White House with classified information on a temporary basis without the chief of staff and the president knowing about it, I don't think.
Kirk, Robert, what is the responsibility of politicians and elected officials who worked with Porter when, you know, it became clear to them that he was accused of this? I mean,
both from a political, I mean, let's there's a couple different aspects to it. From a political standpoint, I think you have to recognize that when this comes out, it's going to look bad for the White House, and you have to kind of protect the president that way. That's one obligation you have. But I think the more fundamental obligation is out of human decency. You don't have somebody working in your White House who is a spousal abuser if you can, you know, verify that that's the case, or if you have suspicion that that's the case. And also, I think from the work standpoint, how does he do his job with that sort of limited temporary security clearance So I think there are different components to it. And especially just, you know, we talked about with the John Stannard thing. In this climate, it's really difficult to try to justify this, right? I mean, if this was something that, you know, he made a mistake once upon a time and you give people second chances, maybe you can make that argument. If he's, you know, if he has abused both of his ex-wives, then, you know, you start seeing a pattern of behavior that you have a harder time justifying. Mm.
You know, before we head to a break, which we have to do here momentarily, I want to squeeze in one more story of people losing positions after allegations against them came to light. And Robert Gerke, this is a
nice
different
segue.
Thank you. It's a different story than those that we've been discussing. It's that Provo Representative Norm Thurston was removed as vice chair of the House Government Operations Committee here at the Utah State Legislature. Tell us why that happened, Robert.
Well, so if you go back a little ways, so he was removed. Sort of the last straw was he apparently made a comment to a woman at the Capitol who was working at the Capitol that she took offense to, and House Speaker Greg Hughes and the Majority Leader Brad Wilson and, you know, Legislative Council called him into a meeting and stripped him of two committee posts. One, he was vice chair of Government Operations Committee. The other one, he was taken off the Health and Human Services Committee. There was a lead up to this because Representative Thurston had been admonished or warned previously not to engage in this kind of behavior because, you know, there had been incidents prior to that.
We don't know what the comments were. We just know that they warranted some sort of action.
Yeah, we don't we don't really know what the comments were. There wasn't like an investigative file that we grandmaed the general counsel's office for any records they had related to this. There wasn't an investigative file. The speaker won't say, the speaker won't even really say that, you know, anything beyond that he took the initiative to take him off. But there was a document that said, you know, that that they had spoke to him about the complying with state and federal workplace harassment laws and his pattern of practice, as they put it, which indicates that this has been a recurring issue, something they've spoken to him about before. Representative Thurston would not address the documents. He said, "I don't know that that's about me," because his name was blacked out. But that you would have to assume that, you know, if you take his word at it, that somebody else was removed from positions in the last week, and that just hasn't happened. So you know, I mean, I think here's where we watch this one fall out. I think, I mean, again, going back to the climate that we're living in, you know, for, well, first, I think the Speaker Hughes took this seriously and took the action that he had at his, you know, at his disposal to, you know, try to send a message to Representative Thurston, who obviously didn't get the prior messages. But I think as we look ahead in this climate, you know, does this have electoral repercussions for Representative Thurston? Is he going to get a challenger, you know, later this year? And is this going to be an issue in his reelection campaign?
Okay, so a corrective measure by the Speaker, or a sort of warning, I guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we'll see what happens if it does play out in the polls. A roller coaster news week for politics. And guys, we have to go to our first break of the show. Stay with us, though, because we will be talking about a bill to put a damper on local officials advocating for public lands protections when we come back. It's Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Tony Semerad, Robert Gerke, and Thomas Burr. This is our weekly Friday morning news roundup, and we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. You can do that by calling 801-355-8255 or posting at sltrib.com. Tony Semerad, health, education, and environment editor with the Tribune. A story from your desk this week had to do with an unusual hearing for a bill that aims to put some restrictions on, for example, a city official somewhere in Utah who wants to speak out in favor of federal land designations, meaning federal land conservation. Let's talk about the bill first, House Bill 136. What exactly would it do?
Okay, so as originally drafted, this is a bill sponsored by Mike Noel, a Republican from Kanab. This would have basically put kind of clamps on municipal officials. I guess the official language is all political subdivisions in Utah. Mm-hmm. And they would essentially have to clear their comments with the House Natural Resources, Agriculture, and Environment Interim Committee. Now, my understanding was that as originally drafted coming into this committee hearing on Tuesday, these restrictions were pretty tough. There was a last-minute, if you will, substitution that essentially, was intended to kind of get clear some initial opposition that was surfacing, that essentially now requires these officials to kind of clear those comments right with the committee, kind of solicit feedback. And there's still some elements of that are unclear. So, for example, if you're advocating for federal designations, you've got to go to the committee. It's unclear if you've got to wait until they're scheduled that month or if you could, you know, sort of mail that in. But if you're opposed to these designations, of course, you don't have to clear those with the committee.
Which jives with sort of the state position on federal public lands protection.
Yeah, and you know, it appears to flow from an intention on Noel and other lawmakers' part to kind of consolidate some of the lobbying that's been going on with regard to these federal designations. And clearly, there was a major storm,
sure,
of people speaking up with regard to the national monuments.
I want to get sort of clarity on this. If the bill passed as it is now, with this, you know, checking with the committee, then someone like, for example, Salt Lake City Mayor Jackie Biskupski, if she made a statement in favor of federal designation for a section of, you know, one of the canyons here, she would be, what, breaking the law if she didn't get approval from the committee first?
That's unclear, too, because the bill does not have, you know, it's not clearly spelling out what sanctions these officials would essentially face. But yeah, that's my understanding. She would have to clear that. She would have to, you know, trot on up during interim day and run these comments by the committee and see if those, you know, get their feedback.
Tony, where is, you know, I guess I'm wondering where this bill's coming from the mind of Mike Noel, obviously, but there's a bit of state overriding local, which isn't the line that you hear all that much at the legislature.
No, that's true, and there are some very interesting sort of exemptions that may reveal what the thinking is. CITLA, the State Trust Lands Agency, which is in the business of buying and selling land quite a bit, they're exempt because the feeling is as they're cutting these deals, they want to be able to maybe advocate for some of these designations to get a better deal. But this pretty clearly reflects a great deal of frustration, especially on behalf of rural lawmakers, at all of the chatter that was going on against their wishes.
Robert Gerke, before we move on to the hearing and the kind of unusual circumstances there, how do you view the intent of this bill?
Well, I mean, the intent is to muzzle any opposing voice. Anybody who doesn't agree with Mike Noel and the cowboys on the Natural Resources Committee, I think it's the origins of this. It stems from the Mountain Accord process, where there was this long process, public comment, et cetera, and they then went back to Congress and asked for a designation of 8,000 acres of wilderness up in the canyons to protect around the ski resorts. They consolidated it and wanted to protect it, and they didn't get, they didn't go to the legislature and say, "Mother, may I?" And so they're losing their heads over this, and also, it also have implications for you mentioned Mayor Biskupski. She was a supporter of preserving bears' ears. That would be prohibited. It goes against, like you touched on, the sort of the notion of local control, that the government closest to the people is, best represents the people. It muzzles opposing voices, or seeks to muzzle opposing voices. It's a power grab by the legislature. I think it's kind of unfortunate that they're going this route. And it's not just elected officials either. I mean, it would prohibit any university professor from advocating for any federal land designation. So you're talking about like scientists who want to preserve dinosaur bones or mm-hmm. things like that. So I think the scope of it is pretty overreaching as well.
Is there a constitutional note attached to that? I mean, just I'm thinking there have to be free speech issues at play here to some extent. Can the legislature really say you can't use your, speech?
I am not sure where the constitutional note on this bill is, because it was a very major substitution going into this Tuesday hearing. And as you were alluding to, in sort of an odd indication of the place of conflict that this is coming from, right, as witnesses were streaming into this hearing on Tuesday, the committee chair, Kevin Stratton, a Republican from Orem, insisted on swearing in witnesses for committee testimony. Now, it's not unheard of on the Hill that happens, but it's rare in my experience. And it kind of infused the hearing with a sense of kind of accusation, and Stratton's remarks, sort of buttressed by quips from Noel, was that, we've been in these things, there have been a lot of emotions, and we've had issues with veracity, and so we've got to swear these witnesses in.
There's an expectation on the chair's part, on Representative Stratton's part, that, someone showing up at this committee hearing was going to lie.
Yeah. And it was remarked on. Susan Duckworth from Salt Lake City said, "Hey, this is harassment." She ended up voting for the bill, but she, she remarked, and others did, that there seemed to be kind of an accusatory intent there.
Hmm. It's only been 5 or 6 years that I've been covering the legislature, but I've never seen any people sworn in to do that. Robert Gerke.
This committee, Representative Noel, and this committee in particular have done this when environmentalists come up and try to speak on bills, because he says they're liars.
Yeah.
Who was there to testify, Tony?
Well, ironically, there ended up being no environmentalists that got a chance to talk. The Utah League of Cities and Towns had expressed some concerns about, local officials' ability to talk on this, and I believe they testified. There was one opponent of the bill from Utah, Dinea Bakay, Willie Gray Eyes, spoke against it, and this was an occasion for Mike Noel to kind of throw out who, incidentally, if I understand right, was not under oath, to throw out a bunch of accusations that some have sort of contested factually.
Okay. Tony, this measure to put restrictions on city officials, local officials, to prevent them from advocating for federal designations like national monuments or wilderness areas or wilderness study areas and so on, the committee advanced it, correct?
Yes, it cleared the committee and now goes, I believe, to the Senate.
I noticed that Salt Lake Democrat Joel Briscoe was the sole dissenting vote, and you just mentioned that he wasn't joined by his Democratic colleague on this committee, Susan Duckworth, in opposing the bill. So this wasn't a party line vote in the end. I don't know if you did reporting or if Mafley did reporting on why she ended up voting for the bill.
I did not hear her reasons for voting for the bill.
Okay. Robert Gerke, any comment there? Just politics at play?
Representative Duckworth is in one of the tougher districts for a Democrat. And I think maybe she saw this as one that doesn't cost her much, right? I mean, I think as we alluded to, it's more or less unenforceable. I think if they actually tried to take action against any mayor or city official or anybody, they're gonna end up going to court and losing. And so, you know, it's one that she felt like she could get a pass on and voted for it.
Okay, well, this
that's speculative though.
Okay. Well, that's your columnist. You could speculate.
Yeah.
This measure advances. It'll soon be debated on the House floor, and we'll see what happens to it there. And then in the Senate, there's still a good deal to cover on the show here. Let's jump into the tax break that lawmakers want to give to energy solutions. And Salt Lake Tribune senior managing editor Matt Canham, back to you now for a look at this bill to offer this credit that would go to a company or sort of fee reduction might be the way
it's
to put it.
It's a fee reduction, not a tax break. And the company is sensitive on that point.
Okay, fee reduction for a company that imports nuclear waste to the state. This is, of course, Energy Solutions. HB 169 has passed the House already. What exactly would it do?
So this would reduce the fee that the Energy Solutions pays by $1.72 million annually. This fee is used to cover inspections of their facility. And call it a user fee, that certain companies and certain industries, we ask them to pay for their own inspections. And this isn't the only one. But this company believes that the fees and taxes they pay are onerous and makes them uncompetitive against others in the industry, though this is a very narrow industry. And obviously, they're the only player in the state here. So what they want to do, that money, they want to take it from the general fund, which is used to pay for the rest of the state, and plug that in so the state's still doing those inspections, and they just see a annual reduction in what they have to pay the state by $1.72 million.
Okay, so diminished inspection fees. This might be kind of a technical question on the sausage grinding of lawmaking at the state legislature. But does a bill like this typically come from a request from industry, or does it come from a lawmaker who wants to answer that?
I don't think Representative Notwell went out and came up with this idea on his own. I think this is coming from the lobbyists for I'm positive this is coming from the lobbyists for Energy Solutions.
And so he says, Notwell again says this is about keeping Energy Solutions competitive because of what, regional competition, Matt Canham?
They just say that they're paying too much and that it's, I guess there's a facility in Texas that has less fees, and so they want to have less fees as well. And they have a lot of supporters. I mean, this bill passed very, very easily.
Well, a lot of supporters. As the Tribune article on this pointed out, it's worth noting that Energy Solutions was the top single donor to members of the legislature last year,
yes.
including money to the sponsor of this bill.
Yeah, they donated $67,700 to 43 state lawmakers. The sponsor of this bill, Representative Notwell, received $6,000 of that. They are the single biggest donor in the state. And, they had people say, like, look, this is a good company and we're charging them an exorbitant rate, that they are good corporate citizens, that they are, don't have environmental problems. So why don't we help them out?
Robert Gerke, go ahead.
Tee that one up for me. I mean, this is one of those things. First off, they're saying this is about, the company's survival, even though the company's doing well enough that they tried to buy their Texas competitor recently. As Utahns have decided that radioactive waste storage is something that we're not really keen on and that we want it to be regulated. And so we have the cost of regulation and we require the company to do that. And for years they've done that. And so now they want a subsidy from taxpayers, and it's a taxpayer giveaway. way, and these lawmakers, these conservative lawmakers, seem to have no problem with it. It's pretty galling, I think, that they are willing to take money away from things like, you know, healthcare for Utahns, or things like roads, or things like, you know, take your pick, and give it to this radioactive waste disposal company that for years has been doing just fine, thank you, you know, with the inspections that are in place. And so, you know, I think it's not surprising, I guess, that it passes. As we mentioned, the campaign contributions certainly play into this. They also, in addition to those campaign contributions, they also sponsor events for the state and county Republican parties. You know, they know where their bread's buttered, and they've done a good job of sort of greasing the rails for this.
But incentives for some industries, you know, I'm assuming that the same deal isn't out there for other industries that have to conduct inspections. Maybe I'll go to Tony Semerad, who's the health, education, and environment reporter editor at the Tribune. And sorry to ask the speculative question, but is this, you know, is there smooth sailing for this bill through the rest of the session?
I would guess so. I mean, I think to me, this entire session is kind of infused with the election year fevery. That sort of bills that you see are kind of typical to this, and I think a pro business stance for a heavy hitter in the state's probably going to get a good reception.
I think the one possible hurdle is that they do have to get it funded. So they've got to come up with $1.7 million in the budget to fund this bill.
That's a good point.
And so they haven't really got to the budgeting part of it. And, you know, the budget's not as flush as some might think. And so, you know, they have to prioritize this over a whole series of other requests. Mm-hmm. They've got $300 million of requests for money this year, and about $80 million to spend. So they've got to prioritize this over a lot of others.
Just quickly, Matt Canna mentioned that lawmakers were saying Energy Solutions, you know, they've been good environmental stewards. But Tony, just going back to you on this, their business itself is importing nuclear waste, which brings with it some considerations from the environmental perspective, long term especially.
Well, I think this goes back to Robert's comment. There's a significant regulatory overhead for the state for this facility. However, you know, it's operated. Department of Environmental Quality is supposed to mount a rigorous inspection and regulatory campaign that costs money. And these are complex facilities. We don't exactly have a lot of money to throw around in that regard.
Okay. Well, we've still got more to cover on the show, but we should probably head to another quick break here. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW Public Radio and Utah Public Radio. Stick around. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Matt Canham, Tony Semerad, and Robert Gerke. It is our Friday morning news roundup. You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 801-355-8255. Let's see. Let's go to another legislative story. And Matt Canham, senior managing editor of the Tribune, a bill that would have required someone to get consent before recording any other party or parties. By the way, all of you right now, are you guys okay with us recording you on this radio show?
Good. All right.
Okay, great.
I give my consent.
Thank you. But there was a lot of public backlash against this bill, and now, as best I can tell, I don't know if it's dead, but Matt, tell us what's the latest.
So just a little bit of background. Essentially, you can record any conversation you were in without telling anybody that you're recording it. That's what you can do in Utah. This bill would take that away. And the reason they take it away is that business leaders in the Salt Lake Chamber and the LDS church leaders didn't want you to have that ability to record bishops or stake presidents or business executives when you talk to them. And they thought that there are certain conversations that should remain private. And so they pushed this bill. Representative Larry Snow is the sponsor. And when the LDS church endorses a bill in the legislature, its chances of passage go way, way, way up.
Right.
And this is one of those where it didn't happen.
A rare exception.
There was immediate backlash, not surprising, including from the news media, who does not like the idea that you'd have to give consent to get a recording of a conversation from a public official who, you know, wasn't acting in their, quote, official duties, unquote, which I don't know what that would even mean. So there was a lot of pushback. The Senate sponsor was Todd Weiler. And just 2 days after this came to light, he said, "It does appear that this original concept was universally hated." That was the quote he gave us. So what they've agreed to do is back off. We are going to stay a one-party consent state, which is the vast majority of the states. Only 12 states require consent. And so Utah is going to stay in the vast majority of states that don't need that second consent. So we'll see where it goes from there.
The Tribune in an editorial pointed out stories where recording kind of made a difference. You know, Mitt Romney's 47% comment, Governor Herbert's Available Jones comment. I don't know if that was actually recorded or not, but
it was.
A quick take on this.
Surreptitiously, yes.
Robert Kirky, what do you make of preserving that?
And also the John Swallow Krispy Kreme meeting, I think, is right. One that would have fit into that category as well. So, yeah, I mean, I think this bill was overbroad. I think from a news media standpoint, obviously, we had concerns about it for the reasons you mentioned. Those were all things that the public would never know about had it not been for a one-party state. You know, when these things kind of pop up out of nowhere, there's sort of an obligation for the sponsors to be able to explain specifically what problem they're trying to fix. And it always is aggravating when bills come up and the sponsors can't point to an instance where the one-party recording has been a problem. The only one we got, or the only one we seemed to get, was, you know, these vague business concerns and then also the Mormon leaks thing that there was concern about. So,
right. Can we actually talk about that for a moment? Because people were concerned, especially those who were opposed to this bill, started talking about instances in which privately or secretly recording interviews with Mormon bishops were a big deal. Why was that an important thing to preserve for some people?
Well, I think because it's for a lot of the people who are going into these sorts of hearings, you know, these are disciplinary hearings in some instances or whatever they are. You know, you like to have some sort of record for your protection. Otherwise, it becomes sort of a star chamber hearing, and you don't, whether or not there's a public right to know in those instances is debatable, I guess. But if you're on the other side of the table, you probably want to have some sort of protection, some sort of record for your protection.
Okay. Before we turn to just a couple of more stories, one on air quality, Matt Canham, you mentioned that this came from the Salt Lake Chamber. The Salt Lake Chamber was presenting the idea to the legislature to stop these private recordings. And maybe this is actually a question for Robert Gerke. Mm. Was there an example that they were pointing to of a problem, or we just didn't get that?
I asked them to put me in touch with one of these companies that's concerned about this, and they didn't do it. They're concerned about intellectual property. If they're in meetings like that where, you know, then IP walks out the door and takes it across the street to a competitor. And so you could envision a scenario, I guess, when that could happen. But I don't know that in those instances recording is necessarily the problem. It's the intellectual property that somebody has in their head. So, yeah, I mean, it seemed to be. Well, I mean, I think the sponsors recognized that they hadn't done their homework, the justification wasn't there,
and that's why this was
away from it.
That's why this was pulled. And so it's dead for the session, essentially.
It sounds like it's dead for the session. They are not giving up on this idea. They might come back with a much, much more limited proposal, but it looks like it would be very hard to happen in the last few weeks of the session.
Okay. I want to turn now just back to Tony Semerad and a conversation about air quality, because there are a number of initiatives making their way through the legislature, and I know this is going to be kind of a vague question for you, Tony, but almost a dozen initiatives to do something about air quality, and I'm going to put you in the uncomfortable position of trying to summarize them for us.
Oh, that's okay. All this and air quality, too. Huh?
Yes.
Quite a session. So, yeah, as you say, about a dozen bills, kind of a twofold focus, mostly focused on vehicle emissions. There's measures to expand the emissions testing on diesel vehicles, both geographically, maybe expanded to Utah County, and then toughen some of the penalties if you violate on those fronts. And interestingly enough, there's an idea to kind of include air quality in the state's driver's ed curriculum to kind of give new drivers an idea of, you know, to not idle and to other ways that they can reduce their emissions.
To let them know that they're responsible for the emissions that are out there.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. You know, maybe perhaps even more interestingly on the appropriations front in terms of how we spend money, the Department of Environmental Quality that come up before in our conversation, they're asking for $350,000 ongoing for three new positions, and what that would address is up to about 9 pollution control plans that the department is supposed to be working on in terms of air quality to kind of get Utah in line with these federal environmental restrictions or standards. You know, we've been violating those for a number of years, and the state's in charge of developing those plans. And we've had probably the most open acknowledgement yet that they're way behind. They have a huge backlog.
And funding these positions will help address that is what the is what lawmakers
correct,
are saying.
Correct.
Okay. There's also Utah needs to have a plan, or pretty soon is going to have a plan for dealing with regional haze around national parks.
Right. So in addition to all of those, and then on top of that, we've got the possibility of some new non-attainment areas being designated by the federal government, which will mean we'll have to have more plans to kind of deal with air pollution.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens when it comes to air quality. It's always a big topic for for residents at the session, and we'll see what comes out of it. Matt Canham, I was hoping to actually save more time for this, but last week we didn't talk about this on the show, that Utah billionaire and philanthropist John Huntsman Sr. died. He died a week ago today. That news broke after we finished the show, and there's no way to squeeze the biographical profile that you wrote last week about him into the last couple of minutes here. But it's a rags-to-riches tale, an outsized impact that he had on the state of Utah. Maybe I'll just direct people to your Salt Lake Tribune article.
Yeah, we have lots of coverage on that. I would say, one, Paul Huntsman, his son, owns our paper. So put that out for make it clear. But John Huntsman, Utah has lots of philanthropists, but no one like John Huntsman. He made $1 billion, well more than that, in the chemical industry, and decided to build things in this state. A cancer institute. He funded a battered woman's shelter. He helped the homeless. He funded the symphony, even though he hated the symphony, just because he thought a city needed one. And he's now trying to build up Utah State's business school. It's not like it's known as one of the world's greatest business schools. He's got them $75 million, and they're trying to grow that. He packed a lot in his last year. The fight with the Huntsman Cancer Institute over what its future is and its funding, and he won that. He handed over the reins of his business to his son, and he was had an illness that racked him with pain.
Was he sick for a long time? Is that right?
Yeah. It was a disease that attacked his joints, and it caused tremendous pain. It happens for – I don't know the name of it, but it happens to people in their 70s pretty regularly. And at the end, he couldn't take it anymore. But he struggled with that for years.
Okay. Public funeral tomorrow at the Huntsman Center at the University of Utah.
That's correct, at 11 a.m.
Okay. Guys, we're low on time, and so we should turn to our final segment of the show, the underplayed stories of the week. And maybe I'll start with Tony Semerad. Tony, do you have an underplayed story?
Yeah, it's hard to argue that climate change is undercovered. However, we've got a weather story, water and weather story today that Utah's coming in at the – well, we're already the warmest winter since November in history, shaping up to be one of at least 5 driest years. And there's a comment in there that we're seeing the kind of winter that our children and grandchildren may see. This may portend of what Utah will look like 20 or 30 years from now. Kind of sobering.
Yeah. Water reserves are down as well in terms of
the snowpack-based reserves are down. And there's also an unfortunate trend that it's starting to melt a little bit earlier than it should. So we may be in for a rough water year.
Okay. Let's go to Robert Gerke for his pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
So mine is self-serving, I guess. Earlier this week, I wrote a column about how there were bills this session that were trying to undermine the initiative process, all these ballot initiatives we've got. Lo and behold, I guess they read my column because a lot of them are falling away. The House yesterday defeated a bill that would have gone against the Count My Vote initiative. Lee Perry has decided to abandon a bill that would have sought to sort of supplant the marijuana initiative. There's one still out there that is looking to sort of take some of the steam out of the Our Schools Now initiative by giving a lot of money to education. But they're making some progress there, I'm hearing. So, check that out. And then one more. I guess Lyle Hilliard had a bill on surrogacy. SB 205 that would have repealed the surrogacy contracts in the state. And it was kind of a remarkable display, I guess, at the hearing. Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox's wife, Abby Cox, went and testified about how she was a surrogate for her sister-in-law. And the bill ended up being defeated in committee.
Check it out at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, your pick for underplayed story.
Jackson Elementary in Salt Lake City was named after Andrew Jackson, the former president and slave owner who is not remembered as the world's greatest individual. And this is a school that's 85% people of color. The students, their parents, and the educators decided they're going to rename it. And they did that in the last week. They named it after Mary Jackson, the first black woman to work as a NASA engineer. She was featured in the movie Hidden Figures.
All right.
Great story.
Change of name. For my part, for Underplayed Story of the Week, I'm going to go with the effective date for Utah's new drunken driving law, that it might get pushed back to 2020 to allow lawmakers more time to study the issue. The .05 law is what I'm talking about. Kathy Stevenson's story about HB 345 is also at sltrib.com. Matt Canham, Tony Semerad, and Robert Gerke, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for being here.
Hey, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks also to Tommy Burr, who joined us earlier in the show. That does it for this edition of Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks are due to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and to our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan, including Tom Williams, Alyssa Roberts, and Spencer Holsey. And many thanks to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts and more at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next week.